didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up. If they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I'd buy you a house. I would buy you a house. And if I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Buy you furniture for your house. Maybe an ice Chesterfield or an ottoman. And if I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I'd buy you a K-car, a nice Reliant ottoman.
We're live.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al, Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures down 5, NASDAQ futures down 6. As we're putting a 50% tariff on now in Brazil, because we don't like them prosecuting the former president. I'm not sure what that has to do with tariffs, but evidently in somebody's mind it does. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I've not heard all of that song or as much of that song from our intro as we played this morning. So,
well, Mr. Lawler is different, shall we say, over there.
I'd forgotten about the K-car.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Actually, one of my old girlfriends had a K-car.
It's hilarious. That was a Chrysler, right?
And a Dodge. There was one of
and
each.
And a Dodge. Okay. One each.
It was a Dodge. Was one an Aspen? What was the other one? Boy.
Yeah. Anyway, the just another interesting run of American products trying to compete with Japanese at the time. So if you ever listen to I think it's called, the group is called Cake. But they do a great song called A Short Skirt and a Long Jacket. It's the refrain is, I want a girl with a short skirt and a long jacket. But it talks about this kind of woman this guy is seeking, but she's changing her name from Kitty to Karen. She's trading in her MG for a Chrysler LeBaron.
God. Well, I mean, the first... everybody talks about, you know, the Japanese cars and how they were allegedly better and so forth. Virtually none of those cars in the were able to deal with. I mean, Chicago is an unusual area for a lot of things, but certainly for their use of salt. And if you had like a Datsun 240Z or something, the legendary 240Z, if you went through one winter here, you were sitting on the chassis. I mean, it just ate those cars. The first Japanese cars came over here just got destroyed by the weather and the salt.
Yeah, my Air Force Academy class had a huge purchase of 260s. The 260Z had come out, and my recollection is, you know, because a bunch of guys were headed to awful places like Minot and, you know, K.I. Sawyer up in the northern peninsula of upper peninsula of Michigan, and, you know, Kinchlow and some other really horrible cold weather bases. And I remember the absolute first thing those guys did after they drove the car off the lot was drive to a Zeebart.
Oh yeah, remember those
facility
guys?
Yeah. And undercoat. Is that place even in business
I
anymore?
Think they I still are. So. You don't remember that the other one was Rusty Jones. Remember those guys?
Yes. Yeah, but you know, get the undercoating on to protect the car from exactly that.
Well, you know what those things, my buddy, one of my buddies at the time, I guess he's still a buddy, so I went to a reunion, his dad managed Evergreen Volkswagen. And when you sold the Volkswagen, you tried to talk people into the undercoating was not exactly rust proofing, but it was a protection of the bottom of the car. And what you did is you essentially sprayed it with like a type of asphalt with some fiber in it or something. It actually weighed It added like 100 pounds to the car.
Yeah, it was not a it was not some you know kind of clear coat or something like
no,
that.
No, God,
it was
no.
It was like a heavy duty plastic.
It wasn't plastic. It was tar. It was a petroleum product.
Well,
it was designed for if you ran over like stones and stuff, they didn't fly up and chip things, so they would start to rust. It was a protectant more than it was a rust proofer. But to the extent that it protected stuff, I guess it was somewhat of a rust proof. But
so what changed? Did we stop? Do we undercoat cars now, or
the metal's totally different. I had a if you look at the 1990s brand of GMC and Chevy, like Tahoes and Suburbans and pickups, versus the 89 was the last of the old kind. I had an 89 Blazer, the big old square ones, and I bought it and I parked it in the street. We had so much snow, Lou. You couldn't, and they plowed the street in, so it was in the street. I was able to get out of the alley in my other truck. That just sat there for a month. when the snow went away, there was like no body left. I mean, they just, wow. Somehow or another in 1990, with the new styles, I think they use all galvanized, I think is what changed.
That would make sense.
Yeah, I think everything was, all your fenders and stuff were all galvanized. I mean, the other stuff was not. It was just, you literally, the stuff just ate through things. But the first Japanese, yeah. You know who did the same thing? Remember Bob Thomas?
Vaguely.
Well, he was the bear kicker that became the Supreme Court judge in Illinois?
Yeah.
I think it was Illinois.
Yeah, right.
And when he got signed by somebody, I don't think he got drafted by the Bears. Wherever he got drafted by, his bonus, the first thing he did at Notre Dame was go out and get a 260Z.
Yeah, they were, my recollection, and there's one of my classmates is a regular listener, and Jeff will correct me on this, but my recollection is that this mass cadet car buy, you know, because you couldn't have a car at the academy until the end of your junior year. And then you were finally allowed to have a car. So this was a huge cultural event at the school, and guys put more thought into their car selection than they did their wives in a lot of cases.
Those things, I think, were under $3,000, weren't they, Lou?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so they arranged for a mass buy of like 250 or 260 of these, maybe 270 of these things.
How do you know which one was yours?
But they had to. I didn't buy one of those.
I'm sad, you know.
I didn't fit in them. But the deal was you had to go down to Tucson, I think, to pick it up.
Really?
And so this dealer had this huge buy of Datsun sports cars, and they got a parking lot. He did it right. He got a parking lot where they parked them all, and the cadets all went out to him, and the guy, you know, stood up in front and yelled, "Gentlemen, start your engines!" And unlike American cars at the time, every one of those cars started, and then you know the drive back to Colorado Springs started, and of course, the local cops, and the state patrol across like three states knew that there were a bunch of over-hormoned, you know, young men with poor impulse control, getting on the road in sports cars, so there were cops like every 5 miles. to hold the speed limit under 50, at 55, and they escorted these guys all the way to the Arizona state line, and then the New Mexico State Police picked them up on I-40 and escorted them all the way to the Colorado state line, and the Colorado Highway Patrol picked them up and you know just posted radar stakeouts everywhere. So it was a bit of a debacle for the guys that planned on just racing back to.
The Bears had their training camp in Platteville. How many guys did get pinched on the way down there?
Oh yeah, the Vikings had the same problem between Mankato, which is where their training camp was, and Minneapolis and Bloomington, where the stadium was. They'd break camp on Friday afternoon for the preseason game, and there'd be cops every 2 miles, you know, with the radar guns out, just waiting. So,
well, one of my fond memories of driving Chicago's expressways, which is about as bad as it gets, right? You know, they had a big shooting yesterday at 2 in the afternoon in the rain. This used to be like in the middle of the night. No, it's not. But anyway, at times you see people racing, people whatever. I mean, if it's on the south side, usually the people are black. If it's on the northwest, tollway that people are white and nice Jeeps and stuff or Porsches. You know, Hispanics might be on the scene. It's wherever you are, it's the people, right? So one morning I'm driving down to see my aunt for breakfast, and some guy flies by me, like, going real fast. And I'm going, what the hell? That's like a regular-looking car. And another guy, and another guy, and another guy. And all of a sudden, I start looking at the plates, Lou. They must have been having a special session of the state legislature. And all these guys are like state senators and reps, or their drivers, heading down to Springfield. One guy after another is going 90, 95 miles an hour going by me. I'm going, now you can't pinch those guys on the way to the assembly, right?
That's hilarious.
All of a sudden, I'm sitting there, about the fifth guy goes by with plates that said, you know, state rep or something. I'm going, what the hell? They must have a emergency meeting this afternoon. They're all pissed off or something.
And they all had diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Hey, I want to raise.
Hey, before you do that, I got a really horrible story from last night.
Oh, okay. I'm always up for a horrible story.
Oh yeah. Well, my buddy, my attorney buddy Bill, his daughter's everybody's very social family, but the oldest one went to Providence. And evidently, that's a very close-knit school where everybody keeps pretty close tabs on your friends that you met there or something. It's Jesuit, right? I think. Providence Friars?
Yes, it is.
But anyway, one of her best friends from there had two daughters down at this camp in Texas.
Camp Mystic.
Yeah, and evidently, when the flood came, they managed, daughters aged 12 and 7, managed to grab onto some big tree limb, and the 12-year-old was strong enough to make it, and the 7-year-old was not. How's that for a horrible story? Imagine what the 12-year-old's going to feel like for the rest of her life.
Yep. That's, I can't imagine the horror that is sweeping through the community of people who had kids there. You know, and some made it, some didn't, and you know, that's, you know, it the kind of random, terrifying thing that happens, and I can't really comprehand it.
I can't either.
I've come close to losing a kid, and it is the most gut-wrenching, awful thing you can imagine, and I can't imagine having to actually live through this and waking up every day and thinking, you know, God, was it all just a horrible dream? Please let it be a dream. And of course, it's not. I'm, you know, my heart goes out to those people, and it's a terrible, awful, horrific, inexplicable event, especially for people of faith, and that's. That's my understanding. It's pretty much that is who was at that thing. It's a religious themed kind
what,
of thing.
What brand of religion do you have any idea? Is it Baptist?
Just Christian. But I'm not, you know, I'm not, I think it was a non-denominational Christian camp. But just a horrifying, awful event.
We're going to try and have, I don't know what day, either maybe tomorrow or Monday, I'm going to try and get my friend Bill Moriarty, civil engineer, and try and make head or tail out of, you know, who keeps up floodplains, who you know, how, because every, in case you don't know it, every state has intricate maps of floodplains and so forth.
Oh, yeah. And floodplains, you know, what's a floodplain and what isn't, but I mean my understanding is they had the camp's been there since 1927. They have had high water through there and through the camp, and the position of the plan was to stay in the cabins and get up off the floor, because the cabins always weathered, and they've had floods, weathered floods through that area, but this was a flood that they had never, like, they'd never seen before, and you know, a number of the cabins didn't weather it.
Well, you can have, so floods are, can be defined many different ways, right?
Yeah.
As can everything. I mean, if you have a flood in Tinley, you know, and the Tinley Creek sneaks over into your backyard, well, okay, it's a pain in the ass for your basement and so forth. It's not the same as being in a mountain area where the water's liable to rush through. You know, one of my friends...
We had one out here the spring of my senior year in college, so 1977, where you've got a comparable kind of thing in terms of water rise, except this was in a canyon, and it came through north of Denver, and I think it killed like 50 or 60 people, but it was literally a flash flood, wall of water goes up inside the confines of the canyon, and I think it went up 30 or 40 feet up the canyon walls, and just it was like a power wash to scrub the canyon of campers, a little village, cars, everything, and swept it all down downstream, and it, you look at this and go, okay, what are your options in terms of prevention for something like that? The short answer is there usually isn't.
Well, the one of my friends from the OEX pit, and still a friend, his kids, I think, were older, but he was still chaperoning his, I think it was the local Catholic school or something, I'm not sure, and they were camping up on Wisconsin River Delta, or whatever you want to call it, and all of a sudden they got a warning, and they got out of there like just in time. Not everybody did. Any place where there's any kind of changes in depth, I mean, I'm just, this is for the listeners, not for you, I know you know all this, don't assume that everything is sort of like Chicago. When it rains, it soaks into the ground. Drive between Vegas and Phoenix sometime, and they say it's the desert, but it's not Lawrence of Arabia, Saudi. We're talking about stuff where the water hits, it's almost like concrete. It just runs. So you in a space of like 3 miles, you'll go over, what, how many, 10 dry washes, Lou?
Yeah, arroyos, they're everywhere. Yeah. And
the minute it rains, they're all full.
They fill. So I don't want to get into a discussion of this because I wanted to flip to another disaster, inexplicable disaster, and that was that Air India crash. And I don't know if you guys have been following.
We're waiting for you because I was reading some stuff on it yesterday.
Yep. So it the inexplicable, the old, I don't know, I'm a huge Sherlock Holmes fan.
Well, give a little bit of a history of this crash.
Okay, so it's the first Boeing 787 fatal. The aircraft takes off out of, I can't remember the name of the town, Punjab or someplace like this. Anyway, it takes off and it gets maybe 300 feet in the air, and then it levels off, maybe 400 feet, levels off, and then just settles down, straight and level, into a part of a city, crashes into
a med school
of apartment buildings. Yeah, into a bunch of buildings that they had there. There was one survivor on the aircraft.
How did that guy walk away, Lou?
Luck.
Wow.
Random combination of forces. But there's one guy. So the immediate reaction was some terrible mechanical fault on the aircraft, because it was videoed all the way. You could see the thing settle down, but you also can see what is called a ram air turbine deployed on the bottom of the aircraft, which only comes out if you have total engine failure. And
so what does that thing do?
It's a ram air turbine. It is a small propeller that pops out from the bottom of the aircraft and spins in the airstream to provide electrical power to certain critical systems on the aircraft when your engines stop providing that electrical power.
It deploys on its own. The pilot doesn't have to do that, right?
Automatically. Okay. Yep. The minute you get, and it triggers when you lose both engines. The odds of both engines failing mechanically at exactly the same time are negligible. Okay. So the immediate reaction was, it's one of two things. It's something common to both engines, like fuel, or they eliminated flap issues and a number of other things. It could have been flap. People thought it was flaps. The key thing was that the aircraft was flying straight and level and just flew straight and level right into the ground.
Yeah, they thought the guy hit the flaps instead of the wheels going up
gear,
switch or something.
Gear, the landing gear was still down. They thought he might have raised the flaps instead of landing. So it's one of two things. It's either some kind of thing common to both engines, and the only thing that is fuel, or it's some human error. So they're they've now, based on the video and apparently based on the flight data recorder, which they've had a look at for a while. By the way, the 30-day preliminary report on this accident is supposed to come out tomorrow, so we should see something formal tomorrow. But a couple of things have happened. One of the things is what didn't happen. There was not a system-wide announcement from ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, to all operators of the 787 that they need to fix something. So the flight data recorders did not show some kind of mechanical or technical problem with the aircraft that required an immediate fix.
You can't believe for a second they didn't put gas in there.
Well, there was, you know, it would be fuel contamination would be what would happen. You would have a contamination of that fuel. So apparently they've eliminated that as a problem because there was no way for the fuel to be contaminated on the aircraft without it contaminating other sources. So now you're focusing on something happening in the cockpit, either a pilot error where they inadvertently raise the flaps, and what they're centering on, according to the reports that I'm seeing now, is that somebody flipped the fuel cutoff switch to the engines. And that is a deliberate, thoughtful act. There's a guard on the switch to prevent it from happening. You can't just whack it accidentally.
Yeah, so it's not something you should be able to hit with your knee.
No, you have to literally raise the guard on the switch and then flip the switch. So was it done inadvertently? Was it done deliberately? They're trying to, but that's going to be
the
issue.
Can either guy in the front seat do that, or is it one switch? It's in the middle of the two, or what?
I think it's a switch between the pilots. So the reason you would have a fuel cutoff switch, and there's one for each engine, is because if you have an engine fire, you want to cut the fuel off to that engine. And so you have this system that allows you to reach over, pop the guard off on the switches, throw the switch, and cut the fuel to that engine. Well, it's possible to do it to both of them simultaneously, and if that happens, they stop running, and they stop running immediately.
Well, when was the? Can they figure out the last minute they had power? I mean, the minute the thing dropped out of the bottom, the little turbo thing, is that the minute they lost power? It looked like they were about 300 feet off the ground. The guy showed that on TV.
I think they actually reached like 450 feet, and then they settled. The flight data recorder will show exactly when those switches were thrown.
Why? I mean, if you're the pilot and you're going to kill yourself, why not just nose it down? Why would you do that?
They don't. Well, so here's another issue. It appears that there were not just two people in the cockpit. It appears right now, at least this is the rumor, that there was somebody flying in what's called the jump seat, which is a seat between the back of the two guys flying the aircraft for a third pilot. And that makes sense. It was a long haul flight. They would have had an augmented crew member so that the guys could, the people in the two seat flying the jet could take a break. So it's possible that guy leaned forward, or whoever it was, leaned forward and flipped the switch between the two people.
It would have been a huge struggle. Unless all three agreed on it.
Not necessarily. I mean, the thing is, you do it, if you're going to do this, you're going to take the airplane down by doing this, you do it on takeoff when there's not enough time to recover.
Can you flip them, if you did it during the, if you're up in the air, can you flip them back on and they start up again?
Yeah, you can restart the engine. If you do it at altitude, you can put the, you know, again, it you lose an engine, or a bird strike, for example. So you've got one engine. The aircraft can fly on one engine. It can actually climb out on one engine. So one engine climb out, you climb out to altitude, you get yourself settled, and then you put the fuel, you turn the fuel back onto the engine, and you go through a restart procedure in midair. So it's possible to restart the engine if you do this at altitude. So the critical time to do it is here. So
this is one hell of a way to kill yourself.
Well, and so nobody You know, I mean, that's the immediate speculation. What was it, German wings?
Yeah, why wouldn't you just put a gun to your head and leave the other people alone?
He wanted to damage the employer. I mean, China's had a situation where we had a pilot who had been demoted who almost certainly crashed an airplane with people on board. You had that German wings flight where the guy had a mental breakdown and flew the airplane into a mountain with a load of people on board. We don't know. We don't know whether it was inadvertent. We may never know.
There's no camera in the cockpit, right? There's just a voice recorder.
I don't think the black boxes have video.
There's got to be somebody yelling, "Hey, what the bleep!" If the guy leaned over and turned it,
could well be, or they could be. You know, you're everybody's looking out the nobody's looking at this at the instrument panel, except that the instrument's right in front of you. You're looking outside as you take off. You're watching the horizon. You're looking at the front instruments. You're not watching anything going on behind you. If this guy reached forward and flipped the switch between the pilots, they may not even have seen it. They would have just lost power. And at that point, you lose power on the engines. You immediately focus on trying to fly the jet and figure out what's going on. They did, as I said, they did get off a Mayday call.
They did not? Yeah.
No, they got a Mayday call.
Yeah.
So they got a Mayday call off. But you know, your first reaction is, what just happened? And you might not see any red lights in front of you. You just realize the airplane's going down. You don't have much time to do anything else except to try to figure out.
Well, you gotta be able to hear. You got no engines.
Yeah, and your first reaction would be, what just happened, and how do I fix this? And they would not have had time, even if they had recognized that switch had been thrown, and that was the cause of the engines going out. They would not have had time to recover.
Well, take yourself out, you take other people out, you take people out on the ground. What an amazing way to be an idiot.
Well, if this guy is depressed, he's not thinking straight anyway. But that's. The question, you know, was it intentional? Was it accidental? But they are focusing on that fuel cutoff switch, according to a bunch of reports, and that is a very clear, straightforward basis for why that aircraft went into the ground. And
That would do it. The engine's off. I mean,
right. It's one of those ways to crash. It's getting more and more difficult to do things to those airplanes to make them crash, and that's one of the ways to do it. And especially if you're not, you know, if you're sitting on the jump seat, you don't have a control column in front of you. You can't take control of the aircraft. You get two guys flying the jet. If you want to take the plane down, this is probably the most expedient way to do it. You could fight those guys.
But when you say a guy sitting in the jump seat, he's probably a pilot.
Oh, he is a pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's there for the long haul. Like I said, he's there as an augmented crew member. So if you want to take a plane down and you're not flying it and you don't want to wait, this is an easy way to do it. But I'm jumping to that part of it. I'm jumping to a conclusion. We don't know if it was inadvertent. I mean, could the guy have accidentally touched it? Could he have thought, "I'm going to do this"?
Did something screw up where the stuff was cut off to the engine because of a mechanical issue in the computer or something?
I mean, theoretically that's possible, but if that was the case, Tom, you would have seen a system-wide announcement go out saying, "If you're operating these aircraft, here's what we saw."
Yeah.
And you need to make certain changes. There would be certain changes they would demand to be
this
made.
This is a really stupid question, but there aren't stupid questions.
Well, strike that.
it was one hell of a fireball, but I guess all right, this is coming from a Southside guy. Someplace somewhere there's the remains of this cockpit. Now what condition they're in, I don't know. Would that switch be in the off position?
It should be, yeah.
I mean, if you can find that, if it's not burned to a cinder, that would be fairly conclusive, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say the cockpit data recorder would be conclusive.
So that will show that somebody turned off. Okay.
Show, and it'll show exactly when it happened. So it records everything that happens in the cockpit in terms of switch positions.
So you don't actually have to find the dashboard, related dashboard, and see switch the other way.
No, that was in the old days. That's in what's the movie Fate is the Hunter. The old days where they go through and look for, you know, pieces of the wreckage. I mean, they will do that, but if it was a mechanical failure or a software glitch, you would have seen a system-wide announcement go out already saying, here's what happened, or here's what you need to fix.
So if that thing hits the press tomorrow, what does that do for everybody?
Well, it'll be a preliminary report, so you're required to issue a preliminary report within 30 days. So they'll come out and say, preliminarily, this is what we found.
One of the idiots in the cockpit intentionally turned the engines off and killed himself and everybody else around him. Boy, that's a powerful sentence.
Yeah. Now, you know, question is whether the Indian government will suppress that or try to suppress that. And it's likely that it will. So let me give you a backstory.
All right, we're gonna skip through break here because this is pretty. S&P futures are even. Nasdaq up 7. So keep talking. There's nothing going on.
Yeah, let me give you a backstory here. So one of my good friends is a heavy duty hitter with NASA and some other things, and he took us on a tour of the Air and Space Museum out at DC over the 4th of July. The Udvar Hazy Museum, which has all the aircraft, including.
Well, so it's not on the mall. Where is this thing? This is.
No. This is out by Dulles.
Okay.
It is an absolutely magnificent museum, and I think it's actually the best aviation museum in the world.
Better than Wright-Patterson?
Yes, because this has aircraft that nobody else has.
Okay.
And they swap things with Wright-Patt, but there's a space shuttle there. And there's also a Concorde, a full-sized Concorde parked in the hangar.
You ever fly one of those?
No. I would have loved to, but no.
I either took off or was landing at Kennedy just as one was taken off, just to watch it was unreal.
Yep.
It lumbers down, all of a sudden it kind of gets airborne, then it goes straight up. I'm going, holy crap, look at that thing.
So you remember one of the last flights of that aircraft was in Paris,
yep.
And it caught fire. And crashed into a village right off the end of the runway, killed everybody on board, and that was pretty much the end of the program.
Well, they had no parts too. They were down to how many planes were flying out of the ones that were bought because they were taking all the parts from the other planes.
They were expensive to operate and never really paid for themselves. But it was a flagship. I mean, it was the pride of the commercial aviation sector in both Britain and France. So the official accident investigation on that. On that mishap that came out was that the plane had run over a piece of metal that had been left, that had fallen off a departing aircraft on the runway. The tires had been cut by this piece of metal and then exploded. One of the exploding tires had the pieces of exploding tire had punched holes in the fuel tank under the wing, and gas had leaked out of that onto the engine, the hot engine surfaces at the back of the aircraft, causing it to burst into flame, and they lost that engine, and then that loss of thrust caused the aircraft to go down on takeoff. The video of it is.
I remember that being the report.
Right. Okay. So, this guy is saying a couple of other factors. I said, like what? And he said the plane was over its max allowable takeoff weight because it was absolutely full. They were flying to, you know, some resort place, Martinique, I think, in the Caribbean. And it was absolutely overloaded with passenger baggage. And they knew this. They had topped off the ground crew had, instead of leaving, you know, filling the plane up 90% with fuel, which is what they always did, because you left space in the gas tanks for expansion of fuel, because the thing was flying at Mach 2. They filled it up all the way to the top. So there was a 10% increase on weight in fuel, in addition to being overweight because of the baggage and passenger load. The pilots were almost certainly unaware that the additional gas had been put on there, so their takeoff data was wrong. So this is all now starting. You're starting to see this momentum swing towards a result that's going to kill everybody. So that's huge. They then are taking off this one runway into the wind, because you always take off into the wind to get your airspeed, a maximum amount of airspeed. The tower diverts them to the downwind runway for takeoff. They're taking off downwind because the president of France was at the other end of that runway, and he and his entourage wanted to watch the aircraft take off over them.
You gotta be kidding me.
No, I'm not. And so they put the aircraft on a downwind runway. Now, normally, not a huge issue, because the aircraft has, the engines are so powerful that it could make the, make the airspeed necessary. But they're now taking off into a downwind runway. Then they hit the metal piece. They're now on fire. So they shut down.
Oh, so they did hit the metal piece.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, they did. They were on fire. That's what I thought. No question. They were on fire. They're on fire with a overweight with reduced airspeed. Okay. Now, the minute you have a situation like that on takeoff, if you've got an engine on fire, the thing you don't do is shut the engine down. You firewall the engine, because you want as much thrust out of that engine as you can possibly get before it fails, because you need to get to altitude. You have to have altitude. The air crew on the aircraft shut the engine down.
So you're still getting a little help of the thing, even though it was on fire.
Right. Oh yeah. Right. Oh yeah. It was at full thrust. What was on fire was the fuel that was coming out of the back of the aircraft. And so the engine still had thrust capability. They shut that engine down. So you're overweight, you are at a reduced takeoff airspeed because you're going downwind, you are on fire, and you shut down the engine at the absolute worst time. And so they did not have enough power to make it. And I asked this guy, so which one was the cause? He goes, well, the cause was the fire. But had they, A, had more airspeed, B, not been over max gross takeoff weight, because that was a huge factor, not been over max gross takeoff weight, they likely would have had enough, they wouldn't have gone down as fast, and they might have had enough time to save the jet. Once they shut that other engine down, the max, the overweight load and the lack of airspeed killed them.
Well, it's amazing the things that, this is, I'm going to take 30 seconds with this. When I used to do sensitivity analysis on projects, and this is a finance question, it's not, but it's amazing how things they would, like building a building or building railroad cars, right? I used to do the railroad car thing, and they'd say, what if, if something happened for 6 months, or what if this happened? Normally, any big shock, if you bid the thing right, you can absorb any kind of a big shock. But if you start getting, a little needles getting stuck in your butt, you're off by 3% on your estimates. You're off by 3% on how long it takes. You're off by 3% on the drawings getting approved. You get four or five of those, even though they all look like nothing by themselves, all of a sudden the project's a disaster.
Yes. Yes.
Way more than one or two being totally screwed up.
And so we, in the I investigated a number of aviation accidents, and you look at this invariably, this chain of events, and if you break the chain, you can break the chain of events leading up to the accident at maybe three or four points, and you don't have a fatality, you don't have a plane crash, but it's this series of events. And like I said, Big Mo, I call it momentum, this momentum in favor of accidents or in favor of something terrible happening just begins to build. And this is true with you know, the Exxon Valdez accident. It's true in aviation accidents. It's almost never, or I mean, sometimes it is. Sometimes a wing breaks off or something, but it's almost never one thing. It's one thing happening on a series of other things that, if you were interrupting that series, you could prevent the accident.
Yeah, there was talk about it.
It's why we in the flying business and in a number of other, you know, the nuclear power business. You think of any place where you've got a catastrophic event. It is absolutely essential you follow every procedure and do it right, because you never know what's going to interpose itself on what looks like a normal process.
There was a guy, Lou, I went to, of all things, I went to Philadelphia because I wanted to see the stadium, and I also wanted to go tour the battleship New Jersey, right? So I'm in this little hotel downtown. It was right on the street, you know, where the Liberty Bell and all that stuff was, and I could walk right down the street to get a little, what do they call it, a taxi cab on the water to go across to where the battleship was, right? So
right.
I'm sitting there in
a tender.
Yeah, they've got you know, a 5-6 stool bar there, right? So I wander down and I sit down, and all of a sudden this guy's all kinds of commotion. He got his Harley and he's parking his Harley in back. Was his Harley safe? Did he have a spot in the guy? I'm thinking, who's this idiot, right? And then of course he sits right next to me. Thinking, well, dude, I come all the way to Philadelphia for this, right? I start talking to the guy. It turns out, I bet you know the guy. The guy, and this is years ago, but it turns out he's the lead investigator for air crashes, or one of them. And he was. Remember the plane went down like by Buffalo, and was it the ICE or something?
Yeah, icing ATR. Yeah,
yeah. And he was just done investigating that, and he's given me the whole story. I'm sitting there going, first I thought this guy was a loser. Now it turns out I'm soaking up every word, right? And I'm the luckiest man on earth listening to the guy. And he was talking about how the pilot had all kinds of hours, and the co-pilot is some lady who evidently was quite the looker, and she didn't have hardly any hours. And the guy was so concerned about picking her up. He says there's a rule that says you can talk about all kinds of personal stuff, but when you get under 10,000 feet, it's all business.
That's exactly right. I remember this.
Yeah, yeah. And evidently something about they got some ice, and she said, you know, we got to gain whatever. We got to put the nose down to get some speed. And he said no, being the big knucklehead, and pulled the thing up, and it stalled and fell, right, or something? Isn't that what happened? Or
they stalled in because they lost because of the ice on the wings. Yep.
And she, if it had done what she wanted to do, it would have been fine, probably. And she had like 50 hours in the plane, and he had like 9 zillion. But he was trying to be a big shot, and whatever, down it went. But it was fascinating. He'd done the one in something else went down. Was it Indiana? Something went down on ice, too? Apparently he was kind of the ice plane expert or something. But he was giving me all these crashes and all of what happened. I'm sitting there. Well, I could have sat and listened to the guy for a month. I mean, he was that.
And again, this goes back to the decision-making process that your people are making. You want, when something bad happens, you know, you want to have every possible advantage at that point. You don't want to be overweight. You don't want to be in a place where you're at a reduced airspeed because you're taking off to impress the president of France. You don't want to have to worry about whether you've shut down the right engine. And so this kind of thing happens, and now there is apparently precedent for somebody, not on this aircraft, but for somebody inadvertently cutting off the gas to both engines simultaneously. In one case, they were at altitude and able to recover. In another, my understanding is they crashed the jet. So it's not like this is unheard of, being an unintentional kind of action. But I raised that this morning because we talk about air crashes here a lot, and all of us are flying, and you know, you something like that happens, you could say to yourself, boy, there but for the grace of whatever goes me. And you know, the story's coming out, and it looks right now like it was some kind of pilot, either pilot error or some kind of an intentional, terrible act by somebody on the aircraft.
Well, we got a few minutes. I want to ask you a minute. I know when I drive you into some, you know, things like you know, money supply and fiscal policy and presidential policy and Fed policy and things like that. I mean, I know half the listeners want to gloss over and reach for the off button, but it is interesting that to put what you just talked about is actually sort of very similar to what I'm going to sort of mention. And we have a thing. It was a lady on yesterday that Russell brought on. She was terrific. She's a finance professor at Indiana, talking about CPI and money supply and why, you know, people are getting nipped by these numbers and they're being told the wrong thing. She didn't want to use the word lie like I do, but she said it's clearly misleading, and especially for people in certain areas where prices just keep going up and so forth. And the thing that's odd about it, Lou, is everybody thinks that like everybody gets hurt or everybody gets helped. And Milton Friedman used to say that one of the biggest scourges of inflation is it's not even, and some people benefit, some don't. And oh, by the way, for those that don't, it's the cruelest tax there is. Now, I don't know if the administration is, you know, pushing this or whatever, because it was happening before they got in. When you do what the world is doing, and everybody's all of a sudden increasing their you know, the money numbers, it's not like nobody wins. When the Weimar Republic, and I know half the listeners don't know what the hell it is, it was the poster child for inflation in Germany. It was between World War One and basically Hitler, right?
Yeah, baskets. They were using baskets of Reichmarks to buy stuff.
But you know who was the world's biggest benefactor of that over there?
Well, inflation like that, it might be, I don't know.
Well, landowners.
What commodities had prices fixed in Deutschmarks?
But I'm saying when you pour money in, the people who bought farms, bought buildings, essentially landowners, within 6 months were paying off their mortgage.
Yeah, because
they thought it was the world's greatest thing.
So anything, yeah, exactly.
And we have people that are, I think, in control of this government. Whether I'm not pointing a finger at one person individually, they benefit dramatically by fixed stuff going up, because generally they have it, stocks, property. God, you know, if Trump had a mortgage on the Doral, it's a lot easier for him to pay it off now than it was 2 years ago. Because, you know, the inflation is up, the room rates are up. There are people that are massive benefactors to this. And the rest of the people sort of aren't. When you see what's happening, Lou, I mean, yesterday I did some work on, NVIDIA hit $4 trillion, right? And if you're like me, you have no idea what $4 trillion, as in like trillion. I got $50 in my pocket. What do you mean by a trillion? NVIDIA is now trading for, you know what the revenue per share, it trades 165 and a half. It's up again today, 164 and a half. You know what the revenue per share is, Lou?
No.
$6.
Huh.
$6. Their earnings are $3.
That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, it doesn't. And in 2000, the stocks at the time, I went through, I remember this because it crashed not that long after, not that I got short or anything like that, but the stocks that were the high flyers at the time, Cisco, Oracle, those kinds of places, they all reached the point, not PE, they reached the point of revenue per share where they were essentially 11, 12 times, the share price were 11, 12 times revenue. Cisco's revenue was about $6 a trade. Stock was trading 66 or something. Now, you can grow into PE. It's really hard to double or triple revenue, right? Especially when your company's by this size. Now, Oracle has had this incredible run since they started telling everybody how good they are at AI. It's up to 239. It's up tremendously this year. And again, it's up $4 today, so please don't sell it on my account. But it's up to 13, 14 times revenue. It's higher by far than it was in 2000. I mean, and Bitcoin made another, Bitcoin, which is basically a fake stock, was an all-time high last night. What are we doing? What are we doing? Who's in charge of this, and why are we doing it? By any metric, we're way more overvalued than we were in 2007 or 2000. and we seem to, everybody seems to love it, and the president's bitching at Powell to do it even more. And what are we doing? Who's in charge of this? Have they ever read an economics book? Well, by the way, Britain's doing the same thing. Japan's doing the same thing.
Oh, I know. This is what's driving Elon Musk crazy, apparently.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's, Tom, this got raised 30 years ago with our buddy H. Ross Perot. And the short answer is there's an element of the population that's going to vote thinking about that. But the vast majority of people either A, don't want to think about it, or B, don't care. As long as they're not being hurt directly.
Well, you care and you are being hurt. You just don't know where to focus it.
That's right. And it's complicated. It's a complicated story. So our press organs don't want to spend time on it because people's eyes glaze over, and when you start talking about this stuff and it doesn't sell clicks. So there you go. The short answer is it's not going to get fixed until it becomes an issue that drives voters, and it's right now it's not. It hasn't been. It wasn't when Perot was making what I thought was a much better case than Musk on debt issues and national debt and financial insecurity.
And people, I don't understand why people believe the numbers. The difference. Really, I think from when I was young and we had the inflation issues, the government didn't lie about the numbers as much as they do now. Now, just we got inflation, just tell them we don't. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying it's a problem. It's a nonpartisan problem. It cuts. I mean this is one of the things. This is one of the elements that Trump and his populist approach have removed from concern of the Republican Party. The Republican Party used to have an element that was a national debt element and argued for fiscal conservativeness and fiscal responsibility and prudence. And that has, as far as I can tell, almost completely disappeared from their platform.
Well, there's a difference between necessarily fiscal conservativeness and what you do with the value of your money. There's quite a difference because people benefit from the...
But this was there was an element of the Republican Party that was constantly singing that song.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And those guys are gone. I mean, they may exist out there in the fringe somewhere or in the ether somewhere, but they are not part of the mainstream Republican platform right now. And they never were part of the Democratic platform. So I don't know where you go to try to find somebody who is going to be responsible enough who can motivate people to do this, probably until we see the crash.
Well, let me kind of run this one by, and this is when I was, maybe because, well, look at it this way. When you and I were young...
And by the way, I absolutely believe you when you tell me that this is unsustainable and we're headed for real problems coming down the road.
What? You think of it as a little... People have always recognized what they were doing. They were legitimate about prices. They cared about them, and they turned the bus around. I mean, what happened in 2000, even though we were running up anyway, you know, with the dot-bomb stuff and the stocks were trading from click-throughs and all that kind of crap, it was exacerbated a little bit by the Fed pouring money into the system for Y2K, which everybody says it was a big nothing, and it didn't happen, and everybody was all wrong. That's not exactly true, correct? But afterward... They realized kind of what they had done, and they started dragging some money back out, which kind of turned the tide. They essentially burst the bubble a little bit on their own. Well, now nobody's going to do that. This is manna from heaven. Let's just keep it going. And we're right back to 5% and 6% money supply growth, which is way too much for an economy that's barely growing. But yeah. I have a question for you, though. Is it? And I maybe because I yeah, we got to dash here in a second, but. Why is it, I mean, I know, you know, a lot of people weren't alive when we had the problem with the stuff, you know, 40 years ago, and inflation and things like that. But anybody, you would think, I mean, mine was the first generation, and yours wasn't because your dad went to college, but I didn't know anybody whose dad went to college. Well, my stepfather did as GI Bill. But you would think that when people started to learn all this stuff, it like could never happen again. You couldn't get a government to have inflation and tell you there wasn't any. I mean people supposedly got educated, you figured nobody could pull that crap off, and yet somehow they are. What are people learning, or are they learning anything?
I think the short answer to your question is that they're not learning this. They're not learning the basic rules of economics. And that, you know, Scott Adams says that the greatest enemy of American democracy are the teacher unions, because they are the ones that are have effectively required a dumbing down of our curricula, less time in school, less time in contact, less effective teaching methods. And under those circumstances, the focus for our education system for many of our schools, especially at the higher levels in secondary school, is not basic citizen education, it's activist education. And so the focus is not on hard things like economic rules or you know, heavy STEM stuff or heavy duty history, thoughtful history, it's on a particular narrative. And so
I don't know.
I realize I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but the short answer is, if you look at the curricula that's being taught in schools these days, and you try to sit down with a person who's coming out of high school into college, they have a very, very narrow, or a much narrower range of knowledge, academic knowledge, than a comparable kid, I think, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, we got a dash, but my nephew's wife, terrific lady, she's a math teacher and. You know, Southwest suburb somewhere, near Southwest suburb, not like Orland or someplace. From what she tells me, there's no agenda. The agenda is just push everybody through. It's not like you're teaching them something else. You're not teaching them anything.
As I said, I don't mean to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I don't think that's being orchestrated by some puppet master somewhere. I think it is a bunch of people with similar philosophies about what needs to be taught, all being produced by our education schools. And this is the product.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like she stops her math class to teach subversion. They don't care if they learn. I mean, it's
no, that's right. That's what I mean. The focus is not on that. Tom, I had a young attorney, and I may have told this story before. I had a young attorney in my office, I remember, like 5 or 6 years ago, who I sat down and we were talking about, sort of basic knowledge that I expected lawyers to have, and the problems with intergenerational intergenerational knowledge and reference points. And I said, so, you know, here's a reference point. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And I looked at her, I said, do you recognize that? And she said, I think I've heard it before.
I would hope so.
And I said, do you know what it is? And she said, no. I think it's famous. And I said, okay, you're an attorney in the state of Illinois. That's the Gettysburg Address. You need to know what that is and who said it and when and why it's important.
Go to the Lincoln Memorial and just read all the stuff on the wall for an afternoon.
Well, but the point is, I got a college grad, and she was at the top of her class in law school and at Marshall. I got in there in Chicago. I have a undergrad and a law school grad who doesn't recognize the opening words to the Gettysburg Address. You got to be kidding me.
Yeah, it's unreal.
Yeah. So there you go.
All right, Luke. All right, take care of yourself. And
see you next week,
Jimmy. We got our guys.
Yes, we do.
Wayne, Andrew, how are you guys? Sorry, we're a little over, but you like to listen in a little bit, so
I am here. If you can hear me,
I can hear you. You're coming in loud. Loud as can be.
I'm here and enjoying the past discussion.
The pretty interesting stuff. I can't believe somebody. I mean, if it turns out that somebody turned the engines off on that plane, what the hell is going through that guy's mind?
No, I'll leave that to Wayne.
I mean, I don't even.
I've been tracking. ICE around the country. What I haven't heard about the plane.
Well, this is the Indian Air crash.
Oh, right. Yeah, that. The last I saw on that is that it had suffered a catastrophic engine failure. But are they saying that the pilot shut down the engines?
Lou's saying that the 30-day report comes out tomorrow. Oh. But he said that, but the fact that no directive has gone out saying you got to check this on your 787s is indicative that they don't think there's anything wrong with the plane. And when they seem like they're zeroing in on somebody flipped the switch to cut the fuel to both engines.
There's definitely something wrong with the FAA, though.
Yeah, well, it's, but I mean,
who now, the guy who's heading up Department of Transportation, Trump just gave him collateral duty to run NASA. So I don't think that situation is going to get any better.
Well, you know, an ounce of talent is worth, or an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of talent. Stuff like that happens. They just had a big, there was supposed to be some Puerto Rican festival in Chicago this weekend, and it got canceled. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah. I didn't realize it got canceled, but that was one of the ICE incidents. I've been tracking ICE on my website because, first of all, Homeland Security is claiming that they're going to start scouring the web for all criticisms of ICE, which, after the Big Beautiful Bill was signed, it will become the largest police force in the United States. And its budget will exceed that of many militaries around the world, as far as, you know, more advanced nations. So I feel that it's my journalistic duty to inform the public of where these icy conditions are being realized, sort of like a weather report.
When are we gonna people gonna wake up and say this is too much?
I think, you know, I mean, showing up at the Puerto Rican National Puerto Rican Cultural Museum at Humboldt Park out your way yesterday, I mean, it seems like they only backed down when they were informed that people born in Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens.
You can't expect them to know that.
Yeah, you would think. And then, of course, Homeland Security had to come out with, they weren't there for that. They were there for, they were doing a narcotics investigation.
Yeah, right.
Well, wouldn't that be the DEA that would show up and something like that?
Well, at least they didn't say there was a sale at McDonald's, 2-for-1 quarter pounders or something.
Right. So, I have a bad feeling this is going to get a lot worse. I don't think there's very few people alive except for people that I know. A 95-year-old lady who was born right near the German-Danish border, she was trapped on the German side, even though she was Danish, trapped on the German side when Denmark was invaded by the Nazis in April 1940, and she spent all the war years basically as a slave laborer at the age of 15 in factories and doing other things in Germany. And she said the last time I spoke to her, she said, "This is reminding me of what it was like in Germany."
Well, I mean, as long as people think it doesn't affect them, they're willing to let just anybody else get hurt, it seems.
Yeah. And
I suppose that's human nature. I don't know, but it's... has there been any... I mean, I know these guys are seemingly trying to control investigations and press or something, but this... And I have to try and find Greg Pappas, who's doing other stuff these days, to try and get me some trade data on copper the day before this copper announcement went out. Now,
yeah.
I mean, for those that don't...
Unbelievable. I mean, there was some... apparently, there was some interesting trades made right before Trump announced the tariff on copper.
Well, just as a heads up, copper's... It trades a lot. It's not a big retail trader. I mean, we do futures for people. I don't think we've ever really done a copper trade. We've had people trade gold and silver and those kinds of things in the futures, and we used to have a boatload of grain traders. I mean, now nobody cares. Well, grain's been so sleepy for a while. PTI in our younger days, we were 45% of our business was futures. A lot of people traded corn, soybeans, all those kinds of things. Yeah. Now nobody really does. I don't know why it's become sleepy markets, but copper, just so you know, copper was been trading. It was under $4 for a while, and I give the number every morning, and it crept its way back to essentially $4, and then it got to $5, and but it's a 25,000 pound contract.
Mm.
So when Trump comes out with this, the next day it was up 60 cents.
And they're getting rid of the penny, so what do they need to
God. Well, but it was up 60 cents. So, 50 cents is $12,500 on a one lot. So 60 cents is even more. So if you knew this was coming and you bought, you know, 10 contracts, God's sake, it's 140 grand.
Yeah,
and I'd be stunned if not any of those buys the day before aren't traced back to people that are friggin' crooks acting as politicians.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. And now we have, you know, Trump with his crazy letters he's sending to all these world leaders that look like they were written by a fifth grader, a poor student, I would add, fifth grader. And now he tosses in with the 50% tariff on Brazil that they've got to drop their criminal charges on his friend, Jair Bolsonaro, who tried to basically overthrow their government after he lost the election in 2022.
What is the connection there? What is the connection between him and that guy? What does he care?
It's a very interesting connection. Andy knows something about this, too. So on January 6th in 2021, Bolsonaro, who was the then far-right president of Brazil, had his son, Eduardo, sitting with all these insurrection planners at the Willard Hotel in Washington and closely coordinating their activities, possibly with the help of the Brazilian embassy in Washington. It was very likely that Eduardo Bolsonaro was there, knowing that his father stood a good chance of not winning re-election the following year, to pick up pointers on how this thing was taking place. Unfortunately, it wasn't successful.
I've stayed at the Willard.
Yeah,
I was in the little bar. I guess it was sitting 5 feet from me is your buddy Newt.
Newt gets around. I used to run into him just on the street sometimes in Washington.
There's a guy. This is a while ago. And he was younger. I was younger. He was sitting there with this couple. I never saw a guy look exactly like he does on TV.
Yeah.
I look at him and go, "It's Newt." It wasn't even like, "Who is that guy?" I mean, he looked exactly. You know, a lot of people don't. I mean, you can almost barely recognize him on their TV, and then you see him in person, but not him. But anyway, what's Trump's connection with this guy? Just he's a right winger?
Oh no. First, just a quick aside for the audience: the Willard is one or two fanciest, most prestigious hotels in Washington. In a way, it's where visiting presidents stay a block from the White House quite often.
But Andrew, wasn't it in big disrepair for like a decade or something before somebody bought it?
Well, there's the rise and fall of hotels, but it's been renovated. And the bar where you are at, it's called the Oval Room, and it's designed to be the exact dimensions and kind of the layout of the Oval Office at the White House. And there's a story before getting to your question. That the word lobbyist comes from people hanging around the Grant administration, in the 1800s, sitting in the lobby, waiting to buttonhole visiting officials coming in for food and drink at the Willard. That's sometimes disputed, but it's such a great story that it's still widely...
Well, didn't Grant have to stay there because they had to repair the White House after the war or something?
He may have. A friend of Wayne and mine, Paul Dixon, has written a wonderful book, On the Spot, which goes through Washington and describes the history of each of these spots. That's just fascinating. But to get to your larger question, it's not just that Newt comes there for a drink, or that the Brazil's president's son was there with other people during January 6th, but an investigative author, reporter Seth Abramson, has put together extensive videos and documents to show that Roger Stone was there, and it was kind of a command headquarters for people who wanted to help plan the insurrection on January 6th, but wanted to stay removed from active involvement in the streets. And so, again, the hotel we're talking about is basically at 14th Street, between 14th and 15th Street. The White House, of course, is at 16th Street on Pennsylvania Avenue. So this hotel is almost equidistant, close to Pennsylvania Avenue, from the White House, and then a couple blocks down was the Trump Hotel, Trump International Hotel. So if you have Roger Stone and all these people at the Willard, this is what investigations should have really nailed, and not just authors and journalists, but this should have been a very high priority for the Biden Justice Department. But there's a lot of evidence there, and to get back to the Brazilian president's son, some people did say, well, why are you here? And he had, why are you in the White House with everything going on in the United States? Why did you go into the White House? You can't actually talk to these people, but these questions are floated at the risk of the people who float them. And what was the reason why? And he said he wanted to congratulate Jared Kushner on his wedding anniversary or something like that. And you look at this and say, hey, come on.
Yeah.
but then you fast forward to this, and you know the fundamental question why you raised it, Tom, is what's going on here? Well, imagine that you're in business and you're somehow involved in planning your future, and you have something to do with either exporting or importing to Brazil, and then you take a look at the news yesterday, you say 50% tariffs. Well, first of all, that makes it impossible to trade. I mean, you don't have a markup of 50%.
Well, I mean, you can make the case that say if you put a 50% markup on medical supplies, you know, where is the markup? I mean, if we're getting a shot of penicillin out of India for $1, and by the time it goes in your behind at Northwestern Hospital, it's $200, I guess 50% on top of $1 makes it $1.50, because all the profits at Northwestern, it's not really at India. So it kind of depends on the product, but yeah, 50% is kind of high. When you know, it's real high, especially if you're talking soybeans and things like that, when you know, there's obviously a competitive market for that stuff.
Well, how do you plan for that? And then if you're a fly on the wall of the White House and you get some inkling of that this is coming, I mean, somebody had to write the letter. Wayne suggests it was a fifth grader or equivalent who may not be capable of
Microsoft Word macro program is what it looks like, because he sent a letter to Her Excellency the President of the whatever Council of whatever of Bosnia Herzegovina, and then if you look down at the salutation, it says Dear Mr. President. So Her Excellency Dear Mr. You know, how do you
he needs a proofreader, I think.
And this happened yesterday, right? Wayne, the Bosnia Herzegovina.
Yeah, day before yesterday. And then this snarky thing to... Now, the funny thing is, he sends this letter to the president of Brazil just as Brazil is wrapping up it being the host of at the BRICS summit, which didn't draw either. Putin didn't go because he's got an arrest warrant out for him.
Or human rights.
Interpol. Yeah. And the Chinese president wasn't there for some other reason, but all the other leaders of the BRICS were in Brazil, and so Trump has been recently castigating BRICS. I guess he doesn't realize that Russia is a member of BRICS, but who's in charge,
guys? On a you know way more about law than I do, and somewhat of a level. I mean, we've seen. I mean, if you read the Constitution, which I don't do that often, and I'm not a scholar by any means, it says something along the lines that, you know, tariffs are basically the business of the Congress, and by the way, revenue bills are supposed to start in the House, and there's language in there. Now, there are laws that have been passed that give some sort of a discretionary and emergency situations for the president to do this without coming to Congress. Same way with the War Powers Act and thing like that. Where does, and we seem to have a Supreme Court that, you know, is a lapdog here. But at some point, when we're talking about a 50% tariff for a prosecution, even the Republican people in Congress have got to say, wait a minute, that's a stretch. There's no that's not an emergency. I mean, you know, if the War Powers Act, and I can't read it verbatim like maybe Luke could or you guys can, but if you declare war on bad people, guess what? We're always at war. There's always going to be a bad person, right? I mean, at some point, even a second grader is going to go, that's not the kind of emergency we talked about when we gave whoever in the Oval Office this power. I mean, even the Republicans, even the people that are afraid of them, have to sit there and go, this is extreme. I mean, I would think, even if they like in general what he's doing or whatever, everybody has to have a limit of some kind. I mean, if you have a friend who's a little wild, you're willing to have him a friend, you're willing to give him a lot of rope because you like the guy and you think he means well, and all of a sudden one day, you know, he gets in a car totally stoned where he shouldn't be driving, you got to go, that's enough. I mean, there's a limit for everything, and why do people seem to think there's no limit with this guy?
Well, there is a limit. We just saw the U.S. Senator from, Republican U.S. Senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, basically say he's had enough and vote against this big budget reconciliation bill. And he's become a critic on other things now.
But now he's quitting. He's gone.
But he'll be around until his term ends a year and a half from now. But what happens in this process is that each person who quits lessens, they have their moment, and then they say what's on their mind, but then they're gone. And so whether it's Adam Kinzinger, the congressman in Illinois, or senators like Jeff Flake from Arizona or Bob Corker from Tennessee, these are not liberal people. That's how they got elected. They're conservatives, but they each say, I can't go with this. And John McCain and most of his family were similar, but then they're gone. And so there's no one left to, except privately, say, gee, we don't really like this, but they're scared to say anything publicly.
Well, that's what I mean. It's becoming a, I mean, it's a very intimidating, you know, when they show up with however many ICE cars in front of a Puerto Rican place, to say it's not intimidating, that's a little bit of hogwash, right? Sure, it's intimidating.
Well, that's part of the value of what Wayne and others are doing in putting together videos of these raids or shows of force. And one of the powerful things that's striking, I mean, there's a number of powerful things, is how many of the federal law enforcers, quote unquote, are in masks and they're wearing like baseball caps and masks, and some of them are appearing with, you know, military gear and weapons, and this is out of some dystopian Hollywood movie, futuristic things that we were, I guess, entertained by 25 years ago when Hollywood portrayed the future, but it's happening on the streets.
Why does we'll start this up before we go to break. We got to make sure we do this break because we got stuff happening. Why does somebody? We have people on the show, a couple of them, you know, very conservative, and that's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you don't learn from anybody unless you agree with on everything. But when you have, I'd say at least two people here are convinced that everybody here who's not a citizen, I won't even say, you know, not here because nobody seems to care if you're here legally on a green card or anything now. So if you're not a citizen now, that's that the work these people are performing, that all of a sudden, I mean, this is to me is absolute horse bleep. They're working for substandard wages, and if you got rid of them and the wage was now standard, that somebody, some son of somebody from Winnetka is going to come and grab that job. I can't think of a bigger load of horseshit on earth.
Well, Tom Homan, the immigration czar and agriculture secretary Rollins have an answer for that. They said, now that we've instituted work requirements for Medicaid, we're going to have plenty of senior citizens and children to go out and pick those crops. And Homan said, I don't see any reason why senior citizens and kids can't pick lettuce.
Is he out of his mind?
Well, Tom Homan, he reminds me, you remember the old Mr. Potato Head? You could take these plastic mouth eyes. Well, he looks like if you took those plastic Mr. Potato Head ears, eyes, nose, and whatnot, and put it on a canned ham, it would look like Tom Homan.
Well, I mean, and again, this is local, and when guys tell me this isn't happening other places, I can't dispute it because I'm not there. But I know that in Chicago, the people who are that you think are working for like next to nothing, no, they're not. I mean, if you want to get, you know, 50 carpenters, 45 of them are going to be Hispanic, and they work hard. And guess what? They're making union wage. They might maybe not all the benefits. I mean, these guys are not. If somebody is going to do a kitchen for you, the dudes he brings, they're not making $10 an hour. That's a fallacy that I don't know where it's coming from. Now maybe in Phoenix or Tucson, maybe they are. I don't know, but here they're not. It's because nobody else wants the job,
right?
I mean, I don't think that's kind of the case at all. I mean, that's one of the big issue. One of the big issues with the restaurant industry is during COVID. You know, paying all these guys not very much. Well, all the restaurants closed, and all these guys got jobs in construction and landscaping. Are making way more.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I live in Florida, and I've had people. We have a lot of Cubans. I don't know what their immigration status, whether they're green card or citizens, but they've done electrical work for me. They've done plumbing work for me, and it's been excellent work.
I've dealt with a few Cuban people. My stepfather's. Well, those days you could call her a secretary and assistant. She was unbelievable. I mean, we got to go to break here in a minute, but I actually bought in my travels around the country buying old trucks, right, I go down to Florida to buy a T-100. This is a long time ago. And this Cuban guy shows up. And I'm looking at him, and, you know, you don't really look at dudes that much. And I'm looking at this guy's arms. He's got forearms like Popeye, right? And I'm going, who the hell is this guy? It turns out he's a guy who does contract IT work. And, you know, he had a year job.
I thought you were going to say contract hits.
Well, but and in his spare time, he's a seventh degree black belt in like four different genres, and takes kids all over Europe for a month of summer to compete in martial arts competition.
Wow.
And I say to the guy, okay, well, let's find a restaurant. And he goes, well, my wife wants to meet you. And I go, your wife? I'm like buying the guy's car, right? He goes, oh, we looked you up on the internet. She listens to your show every morning. She loves it. Yeah. So then the guy, we sit down, and he goes, now look, listen. He goes, this truck is in really good shape. If you get to Indiana and it conks out, don't call your brother, don't call your sister, don't call your wife, call me, I'll come get you. I said, you got to be kidding. He goes, I'm not kidding. And I'm sitting there going, if I only had a place where I could hire this guy or make him my partner, I mean, like, where do you find people like that? I mean, I'm assuming he was a citizen, but I'm not exactly sure. S&P futures down 150, NASDAQ futures up 8. Big movers this morning. Delta had earnings last night. They must be good, because Delta's up a bunch. United Airlines is up $8, so it's 9%. We'll get some of those numbers when we come back. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Got something on your mind?
Give us a call about your stock. 888-76-JOCKS. That's 888-765-6257. Or email us, stocksandjocks@live.com.
Well, the best place to get things on your mind is off.
We're back.
Hello, and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Jim Lohler on the board. S&P futures down 75 cents. NASDAQ futures up 6. Notable stocks here today. Delta had earnings last night. They're up 6.68. That's 13%. It's taking United right with them. They're up 7.67. That's almost 10%. So we've got happiness in the airline industry. Of course, the airfares have been going up, so I guess they're all happy. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 9. Call that flat. It was up a bunch yesterday. FTSE is up today, up 89, 1%. CAC around up 25.3%. So the European stocks, fourth daily gain as investors brush off tariff uncertainty. Of course, this is I keep talking about this as a monetary event. I think it is. Nikkei down 174.4%. Hang Seng up 136.6. Shanghai up 16.5. We have bonds up 1 basis point, 4.36. The Bund unchanged, 2.63. Japan unchanged at 1.51. So that's up from a couple weeks ago. Oil stuck 67.84, down 54 cents. Brent down 44 cents, 69.75. Natural gas up 3 cents, 3.25. RBOB down a penny, 217. This is the big news here with the copper stuff. But the gold is up 790 to 33.28. It's been down the last week. Silver up 39 cents, 37.02. Copper up a dime, 558. So that's up 60 cents roughly since the 50% tariff. And that's a massive move in that thing. And if you were long one futures, 12 grand, almost 13 grand. So, and I didn't have one. I didn't get the memo. But I think somebody might have. The dollar is steady, 117 to the euro and 136 to the pound. So it's steady, but kind of at lower levels than a few weeks ago. Crypto was at a new record yesterday. We're off a little bit. still 110,861. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, your Cubs. Our Cubs lose again.
Yes, they do. It is 7:33 here in Chicago. Right now in Chicago, we are at 71 degrees with a high of around 79. We are going to have possible thundershowers this evening and a low of 73. Out in Phoenix, it's 92 with a high of 114. Again, an extreme weather heat index warning out there. As now for traffic, the inbound Kennedy is running at 31. The inbound Edens is running at 45. The inbound Eisenhower at 21. And the inbound Stevenson only at 12. As you had alluded to, the Cubs did lose again 2-4 to the Twins last night. The White Sox did beat the Blue Jays by 2-1. And the Diamondbacks beat the Padres again 8-2. Back to you, Chief.
I don't imagine either of you guys watched the Cub game last night, but I saw Minnesota execute the, where they had men at first and third, execute the double steal. I haven't seen anybody try that since Little League, let alone be successful. And when I was on an all-star team, all we did was practice that. I can't, what this is if a guy starts to run to second, the catcher throws down to second, the guy immediately stops running, tries to get in the rundown, and allows the guy on third to score. So even though the guy in second's out, the guy in third scores before the guy in second's out, and the run counts. I have not seen that in the major league, I'm going to say, as long as I've watched it. And sure enough, Minnesota pulled it off on the Cubs last night, and I'm sitting there going, not even in Little League. What the hell is that?
Yeah. So you're saying the guy basically stole second, but he was a sacrifice. The guy who was on second stole third, and then what?
No, it's been on first and third. The guy heads down to second. The catcher throws through. Every team has their little shtick where you throw it to the pitcher or the shortstop runs in, and you make it look like you're throwing it to second. So when the guy on third breaks for home, you can gun him down. This guy throws through, one hops the ball into second. The guy stops running. They go to chase him, and whatever, try to go to trace him. Then the guy's running home. They throw home, and the guy's safe. I've not seen that on a professional diamond. It got it 40 years.
It's the element of surprise, and it's basically the catcher's fault, isn't it?
Without a doubt, And he's supposed to fake like he's throwing and get the guy back to third, because you essentially give up the base, right? You're supposed to.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if you guys were listening earlier. What is going on? Well, here's a question for you. Worldwide, with this inflating of these currencies, what in God's name? And I mentioned earlier that anybody who owns something, you guys, the people in Weimar, Germany, that were landowners, were actually gleeful. They paid their mortgages off in 6 months, right, or a year. Is this intentional for the guys who are buying resorts and stuff to be able to pay the mortgages off on money that, this Chief guy is so conspiratorial to me. If I were to buy a hotel, okay, and the room rates are $200 a night, and I've got a mortgage that's fixed, right, and all of a sudden we inflate the hell out of the place to where the room rates are now $400, well, guess what? In nominal dollars, even though my expenses and stuff might have gone up as well, in nominal dollars, I'm doing a hell of a lot better. So when I go to pay that money back to whoever holds my mortgage, I'm paying them back in stuff that's worth a lot less, and I should have a lot more, right? I mean, if everybody walked into their Federal Reserve place and for every dollar in your pocket, they gave you two, okay, everything would double. The price of everything would double, but now if I owed Wayne $10, can I still pay him 10, or do I got to pay him 20? I think if you got a mortgage, you only have to pay him the 10, right? So this is incredibly accretive for people in Trump's situation, and other, not just him personally, but anybody like that, if you have any kind of a mortgage on anything, right?
Well, I mean, a couple of quick thoughts I hope are relevant. First of all, we all like to say, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but...
Well, yeah.
And here's what that does and what it means is, okay, we're not a sap, we don't fall for all this stuff, but there's evidence that suggests that something's rotten in Denmark or wherever. Now, of course, that caveat, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, that actually comes from the 1960s when it was considered a risk of your job as a journalist or professor if you thought that something was wrong with the Warren Report on the JFK assassination. So that gave conspiracy thinking or talk a bad reputation because you risk your credibility. However, in federal criminal law, and I was a reporter covering federal courts for 5 years full time, conspiracy is the most common federal charge there is. And so you don't have to have extreme views of world control by a couple of puppet masters to know that people are charged with conspiracy all the time, and racketeering and conspiracy. And it just means a couple of people or a few people met together to commit other crimes. And so if there's a Wild West situation, whether locally or internationally, sure, some people are going to get together, and arguably some of them are conspiring. Does that make it a conspiracy theory to say we'd like to get to the bottom of it? Not really. That's what prosecutors are supposed to do all the time. So to last part of this, I think, is yeah, there are big and small players who want to get in on what they think might be advantageous, and they don't necessarily want other people to know about it while they make their own killings. What do you think, Tom?
Well, to me, what has been happening really for 20-25 years, and we're right back to it, is we used to actually care about inflation because it has, you know, it feels good for a while for some people, and then all of a sudden doesn't, right? Because it's not even. But if you would have said to somebody in 2000 or 1975 or 1980, wherever it was, and said, what would happen if somebody were to put increase in you know, monetary stock at 5 or 6 or 7% over a period of 20 years, and oh, by the way, we're gonna sort of lie about the CPI, and nobody has escalation clauses in their contracts anymore. I mean, very few people do. And if we're going to do that and we're going to grow at 1 or 2%, everybody who's a first year economics student would sit there and go, wait a minute, you don't want to do that. And here's the 10 things that'll happen, and who gets hurt and who doesn't. I mean, this is like simple math if you've had any economics courses, and yet we're doing it relentlessly. And the people who you would expect to be advantaged are. I mean, it's the reason why anybody who thinks that they're geniuses for being some of these stocks the market's running up on, I mean, they're running up because there's nothing but money around for the people who are. And every day that the market goes up, there's more margin that's available. I mean, NVIDIA is trading for, I don't know if you've heard me earlier, it's trading for, the revenue is $6 a share. And the stock's trading 165. That's way far in excess that the places were in 2000. Now, NVIDIA, to their credit, is growing pretty strong. Okay, so let's say they grow 100% this year, which is really tough even for them. Okay, now it's $12 a share. Does that mean that the stock should be 300 then instead of 164? I mean, the numbers, you guys, I don't know if you guys know what $1 trillion is. I really don't. Every time the stock is up $4, that's $100 billion in market cap. Mm. But it's because they have 25 billion shares outstanding after a split. I mean, last week they were up $8. that was $200 billion. In 2000, there were only like maybe five firms that were worth more than $200 billion. And they went up that much in a week. I mean, we're really talking about funny money, except if you don't have any. Now you got a problem. Because it's not like back in my Pullman days where the inflation went up, you charged the customer more, you gave the unions more, you gave your suppliers more. That's not happening now, is it? Why do I get these, see these contracts people have signed with auto workers and everything? Do any of them even have an escalation clause in them? Well, and if not, why not? Because they know the CPI is going to always come out to be zero, even though it's not zero. I mean, this is almost like an economic nightmare where I think I'm going to wake up someday from.
I think it's a nightmare for a lot of people, in no matter what profession you're in, because everything's been turned topsy-turvy. You know, the FBI has now been emaciated. Its agents sent off to help ICE pick up people at Home Depot. People who work at the State Department are looking at these goofy letters going out. And Trump yesterday, a meeting with some West African presidents, said he was amazed at the English that was spoken by the president of Liberia. Now, Liberia was an American colony founded by freed slaves, and he had to be informed that English is the national language of Liberia.
God.
I mean, this is beyond you know, beyond Thunderdome. You know, it's like Mad Max.
Also, at that same meeting, the president of Senegal openly tried to bribe our president by saying, we're a wonderful place for a golf course. How did the president respond, Wayne?
He says, that's a long way to go golfing. You know, I can go right across over my course in Virginia to golf.
What is happening with the I was going to get to this. What is your opinion of the third party?
Well, the people whose names I've seen associated with it, primarily, of course, it's Musk's idea. But, you know, Andrew Yang, no thank you. You know, third parties, they've had their moments in our history, but generally they fail. Now, the only thing about this potential third party, and I know Mark Cuban's name was, you know, he said he was someone interested, but, you know, this looks like it's a party for billionaires, and I don't think that's going to sell with the current way the economy is. But, you know, you mentioned in the last segment Ross Perot. Well, I remember Ross Perot. He had his big chance was in the 92 race, you know, he petered out at the end. And then he tried again in 96 and it didn't go anywhere. You know, George Wallace, 68, Strom Thurmond, 48. They may have played some part, but generally the third parties don't have any staying power. The only ones that do are the ones that are really, you know, like the libertarians. They're sort of like, I say they're Republicans who, you know, want to smoke dope and fine women.
Well, let me add two things that are not generally known, but one is, if you remember 92, Ross Perot really had his moment, and he, during the spring of that election between a first-time Democratic race by Bill Clinton, or actually he'd kind of run before, but at any rate, he was the nominee for the Democrats, and George H.W. Bush was the Republican. And in the late spring, Ross Perot was really doing great, particularly for a third-party candidate. A lot of people just loved his style, and of course, he was a billionaire, multi-billionaire. And then suddenly he drops out. And there were rumors that he had been threatened, which is why he dropped out. And I later researched that because, you know, you hear scuttlebutt or whatever, threats. And it turns out there's an actual New York Times story, if you look at it, of what the threat was. And it was that his daughter was going to be married that summer, and that the Republican operatives said they're going to accuse her of being a lesbian just before her marriage, and that he thought family first, and he dropped out. But then after the marriage, he came back in. But the momentum was gone. And that's one of the things that can happen in high-level politics. And somebody, I mean, the daughter was getting married, so I don't think she was a lesbian. It was a phony threat. But Musk is far more vulnerable to that type of hardball. And those of us who track that kind of thing, and of course Wayne is one of the great nationwide masters of understanding it with his sources, Musk is far more vulnerable than the average third-party candidate.
Well, something you may not know about the guy we're talking about, the third-party guy with the big ears. Ross Perot is one of my our original huge clients at PTI back in the early 90s. Ended up giving up his citizenship and became a... And the guy was a POW. He was a navigator that got shot down in World War II. So, he didn't like Clinton. All kinds of estate tax worries he had. Anyway, he wanted to get the hell out of here. So, next week maybe I'll go through the estate issue that he had, but we had more important stuff to talk about here. But he ended up becoming a citizen of the Isle of Man with residency in Bermuda.
And he didn't pay any tax.
Oh yeah, no, you pay. What you do if you want to, just for everybody to know, if you decide you want to give up your citizenship, you essentially walk into the embassy or some office in basically April 1st, and you say, by the way, I'm getting rid of my citizenship. Here's my tax return for last year. Here's the check. I'm all paid up. See ya.
Yeah.
So it's not, I mean, once you get there, maybe, but it's not why he left. But I think he said, and this is a long time ago, that the two houses on his block were either Ross Perot's kids or Ross Perot. They already had their escape. So they must have been threatened by something. But here's what I want to just kind of go back to sort of the basics on this. We've had this two-party system for like a long time, and you guys have articulately, as usual, mentioned a few times that there was, quote, a third party. Well, right now, this is just off right out of my ass, I'm going to say 15 to 20% of the Republicans maybe really like this guy. I mean, some people are totally overwhelmed by him. You know, I don't get that, but they are. And maybe 15 to 20% of the Democrats are enamored with the current progressive, I don't know what these guys are thinking, party, because they're sure not me anymore, and I'm a lifelong Democrat. And which leaves 60, 65% in the middle, kind of without anybody, to be perfectly blunt. And this is just me talking. Now, and yet if somebody says, maybe those guys should find some other party to get represented, those guys and ladies, everybody goes, oh man, that'll never happen. Hey, that's just bullshit. Can't do that. Yeah. We're right back to one more party than Russia. I mean, if everybody feels that disaffected by the two parties that are, quote, there, why wouldn't somebody else say, what about us? And the thing that's unique about, and this is where I kind of want to get to the question, you know, too late, huh? Long story short, don't tell it, right? The thing unique about Musk, he didn't mention at all about a president, from what I saw. It's something like five senators, ten representatives. I would be all over, if I had the dough, supporting 15 people that were unencumbered by either side, that could actually read a bill, and instead of saying, how am I supposed to vote on this one, in deciding whether the thing was a good idea or a bad idea, I'd give half my dough if I had a chunk for that effort. And I think those 15 people would be pretty friggin' powerful in today's world. I mean, that's just me. I mean, but if I could find a way to have 20 representatives in there,
here's the problem: they would not be in any sort of governance position in either house, Senate or the House of Representatives. And what would happen is, say you had five independent must party senators, whoever was the majority party in the Senate would determine things like committee assignments, all kinds
okay,
of what offices they get, which is can be a real battleground.
All right, my
in the House.
My very intellectual friends, if the number, if you elected 10 and the Republicans and Democrats are now three short of a majority, you just went from not getting a committee assignment to getting anyone you wanted.
Well, here's the most realistic scenario. It would probably only take 5.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And if he or other donors committed themselves to going through with it, it could certainly affect the Senate, our whole government, the world. But one thing Wayne knows a lot about, but in the interests of speed, efficiency, and getting through his bullet points, is he didn't mention what happened to George Wallace, who, to get back to the presidential level, Wayne can make a pretty good argument that George Wallace would have been the Democratic nominee in 1972 if he hadn't been shot.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he had changed his entire... remember, he started out as a liberal in Alabama, liberal Democrat. I forget who the guy said, look, you're not going to get elected. You got to become a segregationist. You got to... And he switched. And then and that's what he ran on for president.
Yeah, just to interrupt on that quick point, he ran for governor of Alabama in 1956, and of course the whole state was segregated.
Yeah.
Actually, Wallace was, he's a former boxer or blue-collar guy. He was considered the kind of populist, liberal, democratic segregationist against a guy named John Patterson, who really was a big-time racist and beat Wallace, and Wallace vowed, I'll never lose on that issue again. But anyway, 72, Wayne.
72, he had completely dropped the segregation stuff, and he returned to his roots. He was winning primaries in places like Maryland and Michigan, and he was catering to the blue collar. He was talking like a union guy, he was a real threat to really Nixon in that election, because if it had been Wallace instead of McGovern, it would have been, I think, a different outcome altogether with the blue collar support that Wallace was getting. And then, of course, what happened in Laurel, Maryland, he was campaigning at a shopping center, and a guy who had been tracking other presidential candidates, including, Humphrey earlier that year, George McGovern, and he shot Wallace and paralyzed, and that was basically the end of the campaign.
But a liberal from Alabama, there still were no black people in the University of Alabama, right?
Right.
So, I mean, the liberal has a different... I remember reading, you guys know more about this than me, but the GI Bill included everybody, except for the fact that black people couldn't get a mortgage. And by the way, they couldn't get into school, so it didn't help them all that much.
Well, here two quick things on that. One is the shooter, Arthur Bremer, is out of prison, and nobody knows why he shot Wallace. And so, you know, people forget. The guy's out.
Is he still alive?
What's the story here? Yeah.
Yeah. And Hinckley. Hinckley is another one that's out, it's amazing. We don't know hardly anything about them, just like we don't hardly know anything about this guy Crooks, who supposedly shot Trump's ear off up in Pennsylvania.
Well, wait, Hinckley's out? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How old are these guys?
Well, these guys are probably in their 70s, I would think.
Well, I think later. Well, Hinckley's younger. One other quick point to mention an anniversary about. Yesterday was the anniversary of the 14th Amendment giving due process, and the historian Heather Cox Richardson today gets into why we have a due process amendment, and the reason was the 13th Amendment earlier freed the slaves, but the Southerners immediately went back to forcing them to be on slave-like conditions.
Yeah.
And so the Republican Congress, and again, Illinois, such a bulwark of the Union Army, that they said, wait a second, we just fought a war, we won a war, and the Confederates are putting the people back into slavery. So they got through the 14th Amendment that if you're free, you also have rights. So that's the anniversary yesterday on that. And a last quick thing, we were talking about who's going to pick the fruit and so forth. Well, and Wayne knows a lot about this, but there's chatter. Well, if we've got all these millions of illegal immigrants and we're building all these prison farms, can't we just have, or prison facilities, can't we have the illegal immigrants
be assigned to big farms so they can
farms.
Work farms.
To pick the
who gets to own the farms and how much do you have to pay? I want that job.
Oh, yeah. Go down to Mar-a-Lago and find what the the futures price is on that.
It's kind of so bizarre in this whole thing. Dude, there was a guy on this. We don't have much time. It'll be like a minute, but I'm kind of, I get infested with this stuff from Quora. And one guy was a question about the 14th Amendment and how, you know, these people are not citizens. So the guy went through every line of the 14th Amendment. And he goes, the people who wrote this knew the difference between citizen and person because they used both of them. And the fact is, everybody here, every person deserves due process. Not citizen, because they mentioned citizen some other place and then some other place. So whenever in a legal document, if both terms are both used, the people who used them knew the difference.
Yeah.
That's right.
Except maybe now. Heard a Trump letter. But anyway, guys, next week we got stuff to talk about, because I want to keep kind of going on this on these letters stuff. I mean, what do you think would happen? Do you think anybody would care if somebody, and I'm not saying, you know, I have this evidence or anything like that, if all of a sudden five or six high-end people bought copper futures the day before, would anybody in Congress give a crap, or is it okay now?
Oh, don't look at DOJ. They don't do white-collar crime any longer, apparently.
Well, we start our research by looking at that Eddie Murphy movie, Trading Places.
Yeah.
Said orange juice or silver that they were?
Orange juice. Frozen concentrated orange juice. I can see Wayne being Beaks. What do you think? slide the envelope across the garage floor. On that happy note, you guys have a great weekend. SP Futures down 350, NASDAQ Futures up 4. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.